Good? Okay. This is the 15th class in the series, Then and Now, January 28th, 29th, 2008. A couple of things before we turn to the material. I'm going to change the format of the class slightly. Instead of giving people via Facebook, the Facebook group, meditations to do in preparation for the class, I'm going to do a short guided meditation at the end of the class on the material to be practiced for the week, and then at the beginning of the subsequent class, we'll take up people's experience with that practice. A week is not a long time, but it's probably enough to get clear about the mechanics of the meditation and some idea of the issues or the facets of our psyche that it's likely to bring up. This is our second evening on karma. And last time I did an introduction to this topic, fairly general one. And one of the things I gave three analogies to karma: God's will, gravity, and evolution. You're smiling at that, Randy. Any reason?
My logic protests.
Take a mic. There's one behind you, Raquel, there. Your logic protests against which, or all three?
God's will. I'm set off to the side. I don't have any comment on that.
It's an analogy. It's not a categorical statement about the nature of the universe.
It's that sense of determinism versus free will, which we talked about a bit last week.
That links to order and chaos, though. There's both. The problem only arises if you set one against the other, and you follow the Aristotelian logic, that is one or the other. If you don't insist on them being mutually exclusive, then there isn't any problem.
It's hard to imagine how some things can be, some actions can be determined by free will and some actions can be determined by karma. And who decides which?
So you really want a supreme being, do you? Sounds like it. Well, let's take a look at our experience. Do you ever do anything without thinking? In the wrong way?
Condition responses?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what karma is talking about, okay? So that's determined.
But I can always stop and choose whether or not, theoretically.
Well, this takes us back to Yogacara's quote, doesn't it? In theory, there's no difference between practice and theory, and practice there is. I mean, you can say in theory, but there you have just presupposed exactly what we're talking about, that you have free will. The fact is that sometimes we act without thinking, or we act in such ways, in such ways. And there is, no matter how much we put into it, something in us that makes us do that. We look at addiction. And we can say, oh, we always have choice. It's only meaningful to talk about choice when there is the possibility of perceiving an alternative. If you can't perceive an alternative, it's meaningless to talk about choice. In those situations, things are determined. And it isn't that I decide or some supreme being decides. It is largely a matter of the density or solidity of the conditioning and the amount of free attention that is available at any given moment.
It makes more sense thinking about a macro level than day-to-day behaviors, because then I get into that tangleweed of, well, who decides which behavior? At what point do I choose to wake up, and what controls that?
Oh, I don't think you ever choose to wake up.
Isn't that what we've been practicing?
We haven't been practicing choosing to wake up. You're in the middle of a thought. You're in the middle of a thought in meditation. You don't choose to end that thought. That never happens. No? Thoughts take us, conditioning takes us, or decays attention. And it is only when that particular thing exhausts itself that we wake up. In that sense, we don't choose to wake up. What we do choose to do is to engage a discipline which increases the probability that we'll be awake at any given moment. We need to be very clear about this. That is why training and practice is so important, because it's not a choice. The more that we practice, the more momentum we build up in attention, then the greater choice we actually have in our life, because there is more awareness. Our awareness has a greater range of functioning, so we perceive alternatives where there were none before. Okay, does this, am I being too heavy about this?
No, I'm processing it.
Okay.
But wouldn't you say that a beginner meditator at the point of recognition does choose to either continue their thought or...
Yes, at the moment of recognition... At the moment of recognition, the thought has already dumped them. Now, they can choose to go on with the thought, in which they get lost, or they can choose to return to the breath or awareness or whatever. And that is the moment. So right in meditation, you find that we have both free will and determinism. And it's just... Yeah. And... you can regard that, if you want to use a modern analogy, that's fractal. That fractal reproduces itself on all scales in life. And from this point of view, there is no difference between the macro and the micro, because it is the same dynamic operating on different scales. That's how I look at it anyway. And this is why chaos theory and self-similarity and fractals and all that stuff, they're very helpful, because that's exactly how evolution operates. Okay. I heard this, there's something on NPR on the makings of a snowflake. Apparently the number of ways that the water can crystallize in a snowflake vastly outnumbers the number of atoms in the universe. So it's very unlikely you'll ever see two snowflakes the same. Okay. So This evening we're going to go through the 10 non-virtuous acts, and if we have time, the 10 virtuous acts, which form the basis of Buddhist ethics. But before I do that, there was something else I wanted to do, and it slipped my mind. Well, we'll plunge in, and maybe it'll come back to me. In this, Gampopa discusses three kinds of actions that produce karma: the non-virtuous actions, virtuous actions, and meditative states. Whether you call meditative states an action or not, that's a philosophical discussion we don't need to engage right now. Now, within this, there are recognition that there are four factors, and Gampopa doesn't go into this in, explicitly, but it's important. There are four factors which determine the degree to which a given action conditions or sets in process this or sets in motion this process of evolution that I described last time. The four factors are, if I can remember them correctly, the motivation or intention, doing the action or causing it to be done, the object that is acted on, and experiencing the completion of the action. Let's go through those four one by one. If you don't intend the action, that is, just take, we'll take lying for example. You say something which isn't true, but you think it is true. So there's no intention to lie, you just happen to be wrong yourself. That doesn't constitute a lying. It may have the same results, I mean, in terms of how things actually unfold in a given situation, but you haven't conditioned the action of lying in your stream of experience. So there has to be the intention. That's actually recognized in law as the distinction between homicide and manslaughter, for instance. Then there is, you have to do the action, or you have to cause the action to be done, which means you direct somebody to do it and you have the authority or whatever to make them do it. So when you order people to go out and kill, the general reaps all the karma of all the soldiers and so forth. If there's no action or active involvement, again, the conditioning process isn't set in motion. Third, there has to be an actual object, so that thinking that you dreaming or thinking of, about the action doesn't constitute doing the action. And an added aspect of this is the nature of the object. It can affect the degree of conditioning. That is, if you, again, we'll use the example of lying. If you lie to your spiritual teacher, that's a person with whom you have a close relationship, a very important relationship, that has a much greater conditioning effect than if you lie to a person who asks you for change and you say you don't have any, because you don't have the same kind of relationship. So the degree of relationship enters in here. And finally, there is, you have to experience the result. That is, if you tell a lie and the other person isn't fooled or taken in by the lie, there is some karmic conditioning, but you haven't actually deceived anybody. You may have tried to, but you haven't actually deceived. So it's attempted deception. Again, this is recognized legally as the difference between murder and attempted murder. So those are the four conditions which need to be present for the process of conditioning to be set in motion. And when those are all four are present, then things grow within our experience. And there are usually there are four results described. Gampopa breaks them down a little differently because he puts two together. And these are quite important. The first result, which is called the result, the fully ripened or the full maturation result, refers to how your what projections of the world, i.e., one, which one of the six realms, arises from that action. So, if you take lying, for instance, we'll stay with that one. We usually lie because we want something or we feel we need something. So lying usually is coming from desire or greed. So the fully conditioned result of that is to experience the world not providing enough. That's why you lie. And so that's Hungry Ghost Realm, of course. Now, there can be other ones. You can lie because you don't want to admit something to somebody else, maybe out of pride or shame. That would, in turn, produce the full ripening result of either the God Realm or the Animal Realm. The second, the second and third results are the predispositions, and we covered this last week, but I'll repeat them now. The way that we experience the world and the way the world responds to us. So when we lie, we regard people as fools, people who can be deceived. And when we discover that we can do this once, then we create a predisposition to do it again, and it becomes easier and easier to lie. We've created that predisposition within ourselves. Yet at the same time, we are creating the predisposition in others to not to trust us. And the result is that because they don't trust us, we're going to have more and more difficulty, so we are more likely to lie again. So both of these things work in two different ways. To increase the likelihood that we will continue to lie. And this is where it moves towards determinism, you see. And the more conditioned that is, then the more deterministic it becomes. And then the fourth result is the way that we are likely to experience things. This is usually some reflection, though not quite as vivid as the whichever of the six realms. The hungry ghost realm, for instance, is often likened to a desert. So it's said that when you lie, you'll experience things being dusty and rocky in a barren country. But I think all of this, I want to encourage you to look at and think of in mythic terms. So when they go into these very literal things, what is the image describing, and how does that sit with our experience? So if you take the first one, the taking of life, three possible motivations. Gunter got a little carried away with his translation here. We kill because we want something. We kill because we hate something. And we kill because we are indifferent. Basically, the three poisons. Now, these are quite straightforward. Taking life, because you don't know better. And what's specifically referred to is sacrifices, where you think this is virtuous activity, but from the Buddhist point of view, it's not. And then you see that he goes through the maturation of the act. It means that because this is usually coming out of anger, it produces the hell realm. So we experience the world in terms of opposition, because killing is the extreme expression of opposition. Once you've killed, it's easier to kill, and people will tend to attack you because they regard you as dangerous. In Scandinavian culture, back in, I guess, pre-medieval times, where there were basically a bunch of tribes, if you were wandering around looking for work, you had to tell what you'd done in the past. You had to give your resume, whatever. If you had killed somebody, which wasn't unlikely, because tribal societies, you're warring with tribes, it's quite possible. If you had killed somebody, you had to say, "I'd killed somebody." If you didn't tell that person, and they discovered later that you had killed somebody, then you had no protection under the law. And then that person was entitled to do anything that they wanted to. That's where the word outlaw originally came from in our society. It was someone who was outside the protection of the law. But you get there very easily, because you killed somebody, you didn't want anybody to know it. And if you weren't open about it, then you fell outside the law, and you had no protection whatsoever. All of that, those two things, the internal predisposition and the way that the world we experience is predisposed to regard us, all comes under the result similar to the cause. I would say similar to the genesis, because this is... The genesis here is the action of killing, so it creates the internal and external predispositions. And then the general result of the force, it's interesting to translate that as force, because sometimes I've seen it translated as to do with the senses or power, whatever. means that the actor will be born in an inauspicious place where there's little dignity. And other accounts, more detailed accounts, they say I'll be born in a place where there are steep cliffs and deep ravines, and traveling is dangerous, etc. In other words, there are many, many ways you can get killed. Now, what is being described here, if we look at this mythically, is that when you kill, the world becomes a more dangerous place for you. Now, when you think about this, most of us in today's day and age, we kill each other relatively rarely. I know there's a lot of that goes on in America, but it's still relatively rare. It's not an everyday occurrence. However, there are forms of killing which are far more frequent. How many of you sometime have killed? I mean, I doubt that anybody here has killed. Has anybody here killed a human being? You should have to tell us, otherwise you're outside the law. Okay, how many of you have killed the trust of another person? A few heads nod. How many of you killed somebody's affection? Yeah, okay, so there are different forms of killing. And sometimes we do those without knowing that we did it. Sometimes we do it quite intentionally. Sometimes out of anger. Sometimes because we're trying to get something from the person. So the same things apply. So when we consider these 10 non-virtuous acts, I think we should not, I think it's helpful not to take them only literally, but to say, okay, what does this actually mean in the way that I live? I mean, sometimes you kill relationships, so forth. And there is a death. When you fire somebody, if you're in a managerial position, you're killing that person in terms of their job at that company. That's death of the company, is to be fired. When you quit, you're severing that relationship. So it's a form of death as well. Susan.
Forms of killing are as death is change. So how do you distinguish between killing and change?
Intention. And it's exactly as you say. Sometimes things just change. That's it. But sometimes you are the instrument of change and you intend that. So that goes back to those four factors that I was describing at the beginning of this. If there's no motivation, if there's no intention, no preparation for it, then there's no conditioning. But if you tend to do and you act in a way to bring it about, what are you thinking of here?
Nothing specific, but...
Okay, suppose you're in a relationship with someone and you can tell it needs to end. It's not going to go anywhere. And you tell the person, this can't go on. I've got to stop seeing it, whatever. You're killing the relationship. They may not agree with you.
But if there's wisdom in it, then, and they're not seeing it that you are. Like when you discipline a child.
The teachings on karma, for me, are about bringing attention to what we do. And it's not about living utterly purely, because that never happens. We're in this mess. We're compromised. So, yes, we're going to do that, but how we do it, whether we do it, the motivation in it, that influences very significantly how deeply the conditioning goes. If we bring, our full attention to this, to it, and say, okay, and see, this is the way it's going to go, and then we choose whether to set it in motion or not. Sometimes, but our motivation will be, if we bring that kind of attention to it, what is the way this is going to cause the least hurt? What is the way it's going to cause the least suffering? That naturally comes from applying attention. And that's because we don't, once we figure something out that's going to happen, if we're thinking, how can it cause the most hurt, then we're inflicting harm very clearly. So when you're bringing attention to it, you're going to be looking at how can I do this in a way that it is going to cause the least hurt. And so you're bringing full attention to it, and then you act, and you accept the consequences of one's actions. You know, but you cannot escape the fact that you're making a decision to do something that's going to set in motion a process within you. There is a Dujum Rinpoche was one of the great Nyingma teachers of the last century, and the story is told. That he came to a monastery, and every monastery in Nepal and India had dogs. They were basically guard dogs, but they weren't well taken care of. They weren't groomed. They were thrown scraps, so they usually were flea bitten, somewhat mangy curs. In this one monastery, Dujum Rinpoche came to, and it was in the back parts of Nepal, and he rode in on a horse. The dogs were in terrible condition. That is, they had horrible, open, festering sores, and some of which had maggots living in them, things like that. It was just terrible. And he looked at this and said, "Why are these dogs like this?" And one of the monks said, "Well, we can't give them medicine because we'll kill the maggots." And Dujum Rinpoche says, "Heal the dogs, I'll take the karma." You see, so he knew exactly what doing. And that is all we can do, is bring our attention and make those decisions. We get into extremely great difficulties if we try to be completely pure. And as I comment on the Heart Sutra, the motivation that is connected with a search for purity or a desire for purity is anger. And it just and that anger spreads out in the society. The Jains are a religion in India. Along with Hinduism, Buddhism, it's particularly in the west of India or east of India. It's very strong. Jains, J-A-I-N, but it's pronounced Jains. In that tradition, it's kind of an extreme Brahmanism. Every effort is made in the society so that the priests are completely pure. They never have to kill a bug. They wear gauze over their mouths all the time. The water is filtered, so they never drink anything. But the result of this is that everybody in the society is killing things in order that the priests don't. And you get those kinds of displacements necessarily when you go for that kind of extreme purity. Okay? Linnea. Susan, could you give that? Thank you.
I have a.
Uh-oh. I don't like that expression.
I feel like I might have to muddle through my question.
That's fair enough.
Okay. Go ahead. I have a question about mythic language.
Yeah.
And so, on the one hand, I understand the point of reading a text and saying, this is written in mythic language, essentially, so interpret it for your own experience in your life, something along those lines. What I'm wondering is, how do I put this? If I'm not separate from my projections, what's the harm of taking, for instance, the hell realm literally, if it's just another experience?
Well, I have to ask you, what exactly do you mean taking it literally?
I'll give an example. But so, for instance, this came up after hearing someone talk about Buddha being attacked by Mara. And so it brings up, each time you mention the mythic language, I keep thinking about this. So
Buddha was continuously attacked by Mara.
Exactly.
Yeah. You're talking about Stephen Batchelor's talks? Or?
No.
Okay.
So there's one thing to say that Mara is internal, and the experience of whatever it is that I'm battling is internal.
Okay.
And the other thing is to, you know, say, well, this is literally Mara was out here, you know. Okay.
The devil.
Exactly. So I guess what I'm saying is that I feel like I'm here a lot of, this is mythic language, and therefore this is useful to recognize that. I understand that, but then there's this other part of me that is wondering, in consistently placing the quote-unquote devil or the hell realms or the things that we might experience in this place of mythic language, are we not shutting the door to a certain relationship to mystery of, well, if it were just literal, what difference does it make if we don't call it that, call it mythic language?
How are we? I think I'm getting your question, but I just want to check here. How, through the use of the terminology mythic language, are we shutting the door to mystery?
It seems that it implies that the most useful way to relate to it is as mythic language, and that if we were to relate to it...
Most useful way for what? See, you're interesting. You're introducing all kinds of interesting things here. What determines the use?
The extent that we understand the teachings to bring us closer to our experience, or to put it, place us, to help us cultivate presence.
According to Tibetan Buddhist teachings, the world is flat. Do I take that literally or not?
What difference does it make if it's simply a representation of my experience?
Well, if I happen to be a NASA scientist, it's going to make my job a lot more difficult to do those calculations.
That's true.
Also, it may lead to certain incorrect conclusions about the thing, or a way of acting, which was going to put me in conflict with a very large number of people.
I understand that, but that doesn't seem to be the same as accepting without coloring some of the language of, for instance, the hungry ghost, or...
As we touched on when you were doing the six realms, for most people in Asia up till probably the 20th century, those realms actually existed. Maybe they still do for, I don't know. They had physical locations. And the cosmology, or actually in this case, the geology of the world, doesn't give any physical location to the realm, the hungry ghost realms or the animal realms or the god realms or things like that. So this is why I was asking, what do you mean interpret the literally? Now, on another, so take them straight literally doesn't make any sense. On another level, yes, they can be literally true in the sense that when we die, we are born into, or we come to experience another realm, maybe the hell realm, maybe the god realm. It doesn't have any physical location in the same way that our present world doesn't have any physical location. Is that what you're talking about?
Exactly. So
yes. Okay. Now, there is nothing, there's absolutely, from my perspective, nothing wrong. And in fact, from a strictly Buddhist point of view, it's probably more logical to take that interpretation, because there is no thing that dies. You know, it's one of the in the Shangpa tradition we have the teaching of no death, no deviation, and one of the questions is what dies. Well, the body at death, the body just rots. And the mind, there's nothing to the mind, so there's nothing there to die. So in neither case is there anything which dies. So what's death? But it's the nature of mind to experience. So experience arises, just as when we go to, or just as when we're sleeping, one dream ends and another dream arises. We don't go to different worlds, they just arise. And so past, future lives can be like that. But then there isn't any universe. There's just those experiences. And, yeah, that puts you straight into the mystery. I have no problem with that at all.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah. Okay. So, where are we? Okay. Now, I'm not going to go through all of them in this kind of detail. There are three acts which have to do with the body. There is the taking of life, stealing, and inappropriate sexual relationships. There are four which have to do with speech, which to say what is not true, lying, or to deceive through speech, to divide through speech, to hurt through speech, and to waste time through speech. Which are respectively lying, calumny, if you want the old term, slander, and harsh language, and gossip. And then there are three which relate to mind. That is malevolence, or ill will, wishing somebody harm or intending them harm. That in itself is a mental action. Envy, which is connected with desire, wanting what somebody else has. And then the third one is a lovely term, wrong views, which I've toyed with various translations of this. The Tibetan is lokta. Lok is the word for incorrect or the wrong way, and da is the word for view, the way you look at the world. So it's looking at the world in the wrong way. See, there are, if I recall, yeah, that's right. There are three. There are three kinds of wrong views. One is the view that actions, how we act, doesn't have any effect on how we experience things. So it's refusing to acknowledge the working of karma. The second one is the view that spiritual freedom isn't possible. And the third is that the three jewels are meaningless. Well, these are all regarded as expressions of stupidity or ignorance, or however you want to translate it. Well, they are. Because if you look at the way that we act, obviously conditions our experience of the world, creates predispositions and so forth. So how we act does influence the way that we experience the world. To deny that is a form of stupidity. Spiritual freedom isn't possible. Well, effectively, this means that we contradict our own experience, because in every moment in our experience, there is this open quality which we may or may not recognize, but it's there. Where things aren't determined, where there is freedom of choice, there are possibilities, and so to say that there is no possibility of spiritual freedom is to ignore what one actually experiences. That also is a little bit stupid. The three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, can be viewed in many ways. There's the historical Buddha, what he taught, and the fellowship or what have you of the of those who took ordination. The monastic tradition, the monks and nuns. That's the literal interpretation of the Sangha, of the three jewels. But there's a deeper interpretation, and that is, and this comes out when we're taking refuge. What are we actually taking refuge in when we take refuge in Buddha? This goes back to the very first class in this series, and that is the Buddha nature. That is, there is this open dimension to our experience. If you want it formally, we refer to that as emptiness. And when we take refuge in Buddha, we're taking refuge in the fact that there is that open dimension. What we are is not carved in stone. And so there is that possibility, in the way that we were discussing last time when we talked about, or a couple of weeks ago, the importance of zero. The importance of emptiness is that it makes anything possible. So when you're taking refuge in Buddha, we're taking refuge in the emptiness of our mind. That is, anything is possible with that, and that's what Buddha represents there. When we take refuge in the Dharma, we're taking refuge in the clarity, that is, the clarity of mind, clarity of experience, that is, in every mode of experience, this is a possibility of knowing, the potential for knowing. And pure knowing, not knowing through the intellect, not even knowing through our emotions, but just natural knowing that is present in each moment of experience. That's what the Dharma refers to, is that the clarity is that potential. When you have that openness and clarity, then experience arises without restriction. This is what the Sangha represents. And so when you take refuge in the three jewels, you're actually taking refuge in mind itself. Empty, clear, unrestricted knowing. Now, that's what's there. So if you regard that as, you know, being meaningless, etc., that's another kind of stupidity or ignoring. So this particular one, wrong views, is not about beliefs at all. And the use of the term wrong views can easily steer us in that direction. It isn't about beliefs at all. It is actually having beliefs which prevent us from relating to what our experience actually is. That's what wrong views mean. So I wanted to go into that one in a little more detail, because there's a lot of confusion about that one. Another one that is worth touching on, because it touches on many people's lives, is the inappropriate sexual relations. And Buddhist texts can be quite explicit on this subject. It says, improper parts are improper sexual relationships can have improper sexual partner, place, number, behavior, improper parts of the mouth and the anus, and so forth. Improper times or during a retreat, or when pregnant, or when nursing, etc. Improper numbers to have more than intercourse more than five times at one go. People are saying, "Dream on." again, without getting caught in the details, what is the underlying message? What are they really pointing to? Sexual desire can and does, in some people, become obsessive. And what is being pointed here is having some limit on knowing some restraint in sexual desire, so it isn't just an obsession that is running rampant, because that leads one to live a life, terminology you would use today would be one of sexual addiction, which can be a major problem. A lot of these actual strictures come, in my opinion, from the culture in which existed back then, which had very, very significant tribal elements to it. So there is, in tribes, in tribal cultures, what is the most important thing for the tribe?
To live on, procreate?
Yep, procreation. And so anything which diminished the probability of procreation was taboo. It makes sense? So that's why you get a lot of these strictures in there. It was very much oriented towards tribal culture. With we no longer live in tribal cultures, though it's possible the Earth may revert to that at some point in the future. If there's enough of us versus them. And also, certainly with the advent of birth control, etc., it's now possible to engage in sexual relationships without having to consider the inevitable consequences, i.e. pregnancy. So there's a lot more freedom, which is fine in one way, but also means that one's approach to it actually has to be internalized much more deeply. Like, what am I actually doing in sexual relations? Because the way I prefer to translate this now is as inappropriate sexual relationships, because most people in this culture are going to have more than one partner. And so there's this whole transition period from one partner to another, which is where people usually get hurt, where things really go nuts. So inappropriate sexual relations would be sexual relations which cause pain and suffering for people. And so in my opinion, this whole section is about being careful how we are interacting with others sexually so that we don't cause them and ourselves suffering. And that there's an exercise of attention there, just as there is in all of the others. If you've taken monastic ordination, of course, then any form of sexual activity is inappropriate, because you've taken a vow not to have any sexual, not to express yourself sexually. So that's a very different situation from our lives, where we're living as lay people, in a sense. Yes, Molly.
Just quickly, so this wasn't written necessarily for the monks, the monastic community.
No, I mean, you get into the Vinaya, which is the Sanskrit word for the monastic code. It becomes quite funny, because, and it's a wonderful lesson in human fallibility. Buddha said, "Okay, you take this vow not to have sexual intercourse, if you're a monk or a nun." So, next section is, well, is a quarter inch okay? Buddha says, no. Okay, I'll, how about a corpse? No. What about animals? No. So it goes through all of these different things, because obviously monks were trying to figure out some way out of this. And so it goes. So you can go through all of this in the video. And it's all translated into English, so just enjoy. But this is where all of the extra vows came from, because, and it wasn't just with sex, it was stealing, it was with killing, things like that. Everybody trying to figure out a way to get out of the actual intention of the vow. So, again, I want to encourage you not to base your practice on applying, assimilating all of this absolutely literally. I want to encourage you to think and reflect in yourselves, what does this actually mean in terms of how I relate to the world? What is it trying to tell me? Buddha's last words, reportedly, are, I have shown you, and it's usually translated as the way, but it probably could equally be as well translated as, I have shown you a way, work out your own freedom. Now, this is extraordinary. I mean, when you come to religious traditions, because Buddha there is saying, simply, I've shown you what is possible. You have to do it yourself. And this, to me, is right at the heart of Buddhist practice. It is not about following rules, though you'll get many who take that interpretation of it, and that's fine. But it is about, okay, I have this problem. I don't experience being free, just the way you're supposing. You're proposing earlier in this evening, Randy. I don't experience being free. I have the stuff which runs in me and runs my life, creates suffering for myself and others. I want to find a way, not the way, just want to take note of that, a way to live which doesn't do this. And the answer to that, and this we get on way at the end of this book, is, one, is this possible? And Buddha's answer was, yes, I found that this is possible. And how to do it, and basically it's a life of attention. And that's summarized in the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay. So now our task is, how do I find a way to live in attention? We have a huge body of experience and the wisdom of that experience that comes down to us over 2,500 years of history. It's a very, very long time. It really is a very, very long time. And people practicing and thinking about these things, and every one of them thinking it through for themselves, because that's the only way that it's actually come about. And that's what gives the vitality and vibrancy to Buddhist teaching, is that in each generation, each person has to work this through for themselves. We can draw on that experience. We know certain things are very unlikely to work. We don't know that they don't work. Maybe they will work for us, but they're very unlikely to. So we use them probably as only as extreme measures, you know, when everything else fails. And we have a very large body of things that are very likely to work. But we still, within all of that, have to find what works for us. The teacher has a certain role in that, in the way that we discussed before, in that we can't always see what is getting in our way, and the teacher is able to show us the possibility of presence, train us in the skills, and also to point out what is actually getting in our way. Because he or she may be able to see that where we cannot. But all of this is about fashioning our own way, which one can argue may be the way, but even if it is the way, it's we have to travel it. Do you follow? So in reading this, I want this is why I'm offering these different perspectives and why I'm using such phrases as mythic language, because when I was studying in India, there, you know, Rinpoche insisted that we take all of this absolutely literally true, because that was the culture in which he lived and practiced. But it was a very different culture. Rinpoche once told me that before he left Tibet, he had heard rumors about the First World War. He hadn't heard a thing about the Second World War. I was like, oh, there's this big war, was there? Oh, it must have been really important. The same is true of the monks at Sinai. When the Israel took over the Sinai Peninsula after the Six-Day War back in 1967, Mount Sinai, which is a really important pilgrimage place in the Jewish tradition, because that's where Moses received the Ten Commandments. So really important. Well, there's been a monastery, and it's right in the middle of the Sinai Desert, and there's been a monastery there for centuries. And so all of these modern Israelis showed up at this, and the monks, what's this? And they had never heard about the Second World War. So these are different cultures, and what we have to do is find how to use this material in a way that is relevant in this culture. Now, there are some who say it has to be done this way. This is the tradition. And then you get into a very interesting discussion of what is exactly is the tradition. For me, and I'm speaking very personally here, what the tradition is talking about and what the transmission and so forth is talking about is this quality of wakefulness. And everything else is form, and form changes over time. Some of the forms are more useful and sometimes than others. And that's how I look at it. But others will disagree with that. Okay, Raquel.
So when Buddha said a way, do you think he was...
I don't know whether he said a way or the way, because in that particular language, there weren't any indefinite or definite articles. So we don't know. He said way.
Was he leaving an opening for other traditions in the future, in the past?
Well, I think so, yes. I mean, he was saying, find your way. Work it out for yourself. You see,
I mean, even other religions, not just other.
But Buddhism doesn't even think in those terms. Because if you find freedom through another religion, well, fine, that was your way. And it doesn't set up itself in opposition to other religions, which drives other religions nuts. That's why you have, certainly in the 70s, in the 80s, it was actually more like 60s and 70s, you had a large number of Catholic priests training very, very deeply in Zen. I mean, to the point that they were recognized as very qualified Zen teachers. And they would do this, and they would teach these methods as part of Catholic contemplative techniques. That was discouraged by fairly strongly by the most recent pope. Pardon?
No surprise there.
No. But one of my students in Florida sometimes goes to retreat with a Jesuit priest who teaches Zen practice. There was a wonderful person, a very interesting person. I can't remember his name now. He was an Indian who traveled around India and learned all of the religions in India, which is no small, well, I would say all of them, but a lot of the religions in India, certainly all the major ones, and didn't find answers to his spiritual questions. Kunu Lama, that's right. I had the occasion to meet him once briefly. And then he moved, he journeyed to Tibet, where he learned the four major traditions of Tibetan Buddhism, practiced them. And he was highly regarded because he was such a brilliant Sanskrit scholar. And since he learned Tibetan, he was one of the people who actually knew both of these languages. Because Tibetans didn't really know Sanskrit because they hadn't been in touch with India for 1,000 years. So the Gelugpas loved him. And to the point that even though he was married, they allowed him to stay in monasteries. because he had all of this authority, and he had a photographic memory. If you met him, it didn't matter if it was like 50 years later, he recognized who you were on that occasion. And so he was, and he lived very, very humbly. Apparently, he was once asked, "You've studied all of these religions. Which is the best?" You know, this stupid kind of question. A typical journalist question. And he thought for a few minutes and then responded, "I don't think I can say. However, if you study Buddhism, you will find that your understanding of your own religious tradition will deepen." And so Buddhism doesn't set itself against other traditions because it is about finding a way. Now, having put that out on the internet, I'll probably have all kinds of people writing me nasty emails disagreeing with me. But that's how I look at it. Because I do see Buddhism more as a set of tools. I certainly don't see Buddhism as a set of beliefs or as a set of forms or anything like that. But there are other people for whom that is how they relate to Buddhism. So I don't want to say that they're doing it wrong. But this is how I view it. Is this helpful? Okay. Now, I think the rest of this is pretty straightforward. I don't need to go through each one of these. I'm going to spend a little time. We should go through meritorious karma. These are the opposites. But what's important here is that virtuous or meritorious actions can be just as conditioning as non-meritorious ones. Generally, they will lead to more openness and clarity, but because they aren't based to the same extent on reactivity, but they still condition one. And this is why doing good isn't enough to become free in Buddhist practice. You can't do this by good works alone. There has to be insight and understanding. That's why we have this very famous line, which is one of my teacher's, very famous verse, which is one of my teacher's favorite. Cease to do evil, learn to do good, train your own mind. These are the Buddhist teachings. And the third one is about training your mind in being able to see things as they actually are, see things without the projection of thought and emotion. This is why we have the direct awareness traditions such as Mahamudra and Dzogchen in the Tibetan tradition, Shikantaza in the Zen tradition, and so forth. So that brings about a quality of wakefulness which is not subsumed in either, particularly not non-virtuous activity, but is also not included in virtuous activity. It's not intrinsically there in virtuous activity. There's the third kind of karma that Gampopa discusses, is what happens when you get attached to meditative states. Now, these are the... some of you may have heard of what are called the four jhanas, which is jhana in Pali, J-A-N-A, but in Sanskrit, dhyana, D-H-Y-A-N-A. These are four levels of the resting mind. But it's just the resting mind, and they're described, I think, in the first one, there's some examination and investigation and joy and equanimity, I think, are the four.
What
Well, Gunter translates them as examination, investigation, joy, which is also translated sometimes as rapture or bliss. And I think the fourth one's equanimity. I can't remember. Probably in one of Gunter's notes, because he's very, very thorough about this kind of thing. Now, when I was studying this stuff, these seemed extremely remote. But in 1996, I was in Boston at a Buddhist conference, and I took a workshop, afternoon workshop, with Henipona Gunaratna, who is a Sri Lankan monk, teaches in Virginia, if I remember correctly. And here are the four. I was not correct. There's examination, investigation, examination, joy, and bliss. Those are the four characteristics. And he taught, this is just a 90-minute thing, and he taught this stuff, and it was just like listening to a string quartet. His teaching was so clear and so beautiful. It was just wonderful. These aren't, because the sense that I got, because even though they're in the Tibetan tradition, they aren't practiced that much. Alan Wallace has done a lot of work in this area. But the way Gunaratna described it, it was like, oh. And he said very simple things. You rest attention on the breath. And at a certain point, the breath and mind join. And when that happens, both mind and body relax. And you experience some joy and even some bliss. So the first stage is where there's still you're paying attention to how you're doing. That's what the examination and investigation is about. But as you progress through the jhanas, you're acquiring such momentum that you don't need to do that examination and checking of your experience falls away. And now you just experience bliss or joy and bliss. And those even become more and more subtle until you just have the resting mind. There is a book by Gunaratna on these. There's a tradition coming out of Ayakema which teaches these as states of meditation, which a lot of people find very helpful. The point here is that unless one intentionally cultivates a knowing quality, a seeing quality, these become states of extreme quietude. And so you just hang out in these things for extremely long periods of time, which is what is described here. And it does not, resting this way by itself doesn't lead to freedom. It leads to very, very little suffering, and that's why you get into the form realm gods, which you just hang out in meditation for eons, and into the formless realms, which is even more subtle, so that any sense of a body begins to dissolve, and you can't tell whether you're really aware or not, because the mind is just very, very still. But stillness alone isn't enough. There has to be that quality. So there's a kind of karma which comes that you can condition yourself to these very, very still states, develop a kind of attachment to them, so you hang out in them. And that's what this whole section is about. I'm not going to go into it in any more detail than that. Is this clear enough? Yeah.
So you're to not do that, you need to bring a seeing quality.
Yeah, that's why we have insight practice, because it does that. Now, if you want to meditate in the old way, the practice meditation in the old way, one of the third Karmapa is Rangjung Dorje, who's the first Karmapa was a direct student of Gampopa. So this is a couple of generations later. His teacher wouldn't let him do any kind of insight practice until he had done resting practice for 3 years solid, like in retreat kind of things, because he wanted he wanted that power and momentum of that resting in place before he introduced him. So there's resting is very, very important. There's a lot that comes out of the resting, but just cultivating stillness isn't enough. Gampopa said of one of his students, he's up in the mountains and he's trying very, very hard not to have any thoughts. If he hadn't regarded thoughts as an enemy, he would have been enlightened ages ago. So our path's a little bit different in that, but the oh, there's something I forgot to bring tonight. That's unfortunate. We're almost there. And I've gone over because I wanted to lead you in a guided meditation. Okay, let's do that very briefly. What I want you to do over the next week is to get a sense of the conditioning effect of action. So let's take the one that we discussed this evening, lying.
Which one?
Lying. So, for this, let your body and mind settle for a few minutes. And consider a situation in which you actually did lie, or one in which you can see lying. For whatever reason, we're not going into the reason. And what I want you to do is just call the situation to mind. Bring into your attention, into your attention, your intention to lie. And note what happens in your body. Don't try and change it or eliminate it. But as you think about lying and you intend not to tell the truth here, what happens in your body? And using your breath, just be in that experience. And what happens emotionally? Anxiety, peace, anger, desire. Conviction. Keep in touch with the physical body sensations, but include what happens emotionally. Maybe there's conflict. And when you're able to stay present in all of that, then include the stories. Why is it necessary to lie here? Why it's a good idea? Why it isn't a good idea? We usually have those stuff, all of that stuff flying around. Keeping the body sensations and the emotional sensations. And now all the stories, the rationalizations, the defenses, the injunctions, so forth. Now you are in the experience. And this is just the experience of intending to lie. We can do the same for the actual action of lying. Which we don't have time for this evening. And then we can do the same for experiencing the completion of the lie. That this person is deceived. So that's what I'd like you to do in terms of meditation practice over the next week. Take a number of these unwholesome or wholesome actions and play through them. Now, we just did this in just a very few minutes, but realistically, you probably spend 10 or 15 minutes going through this. So you, in each of the three stages, intending, doing, and completing, you experience the body, the emotions, and the stories, which includes the pros for and against, all of that, at each stage. And by the time you do this, you'll probably get a pretty good idea of what habituations are being laid down in your system through the act of lying. And then you might consider, how do you feel about that? I usually don't feel very good about it. But you may be different. Okay, is this clear? Any questions on it? You like this practice, Raquel?
Like? I wouldn't choose that word.
What word would you choose?
Challenging, humbling.
Okay. Any questions? Okay, we'll close here for this evening then. Susan, please.